sukadam kevalam jnanamurtim dvandvatitam kagasadrisham tatvamasyadilakshyam ekam nityam vimalam achalam sarvadi sakshibhutam bhavatitam trigunarahitam satgurum tam namami om tvameva mata chavita tvameva tvameva bandhushcha sakha tvameva tvameva vidya dravinam tvameva tvameva sarvam mama deva deva tvameva sarvam mama deva deva om.
Sahanavavatu, sahanaubhunaktu, saha viryam karavavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti.
Understand how the Upanishad can be revealed knowledge. If they are, then Darwin's theory of evolution is wrong. Indeed, we cannot imagine monkeys, our ancestors, passing down the Shastra orally. Even the hunters, gatherers, fighting with clubs, dinosaurs, it's hard to imagine them handing down the Shastras. It seems much more a question of sheer belief rather than understanding. Can you unfold this point, please? Yeah. What the Shastra itself as a means of knowledge is not going to have kind of a quarrel with what we find or discover as scientific fact, mathematics, all of these type of things that we are unfolding and our knowledge is growing around what is actually going on within the universe. So the first part of the Vedas or the second part of the Vedas are not really a treatise on that. So when this knowledge has come, it's considered as a revealed knowledge. Well, one thing before that, the jivas, say this universe is cyclical, comes into manifestation, sustains, and goes back. At some point in that process of unfoldment and manifestation, there are human upadis, but before that there are dinosaur upadis or monkey upadis or whatever happens to be there. The farther back you go, if you look at the creation as an evolutionary process. But say that evolutionary process, or however you want to look at it, is something that takes place in time, over the millions of years. And the subtle bodies will, over that millions of years of going through all of the yugas, those subtle bodies will take upadis that are appropriate for them at that particular time. And so, say if you go back to, say, the beginning of the creation, and you look at it as an evolution of all of the upadis, a continuing evolution of all of the upadis. At some time, maybe in the Satya Yuga, the upadis that were available at that time would fit you as a Sukshma Sharira. You're not, the subtle body is not evolving. It's this physical plane that is going through this evolution. The subtle body will actually, if we think about the types of bodies it takes in this plane, you know, say we say this bhūloka, this middle plane, it will be taking bodies that are appropriate to it at the time of the death of the previous incarnation. And so that could mean that you're having a body with about the same type of capacity or less capacity, or perhaps taking an animal body or different types of animal bodies, depending upon what your karmas, the type of upadis your karmas would attract. And it could also be more positive bodies. Maybe you take the body of a deva, or the body of an exalted human being, in the sense of that maybe the health of their body or their intelligence or the type of life that they live. That all is dependent upon really the moment of your last life, who you were at that time. So you could actually be continually getting better and better and better bodies, or it could be like this and then down, like this and down. It's not, don't think of evolution in terms of the subtle body. And don't think of evolution in terms of the type of bodies you take. Like you say, okay, well, I must have started out as an amoeba. And, you know, and then I became a little bit more sophisticated, on and on and on. That can be true of the upadis, the physical upadis, as they themselves develop. But not the Sukshma Sharira who is taking those upadis. See what I mean? So don't think of evolution in reference to the jiva. It's evolution in reference to the upadis that are growing and maturing and adjusting to the environment and to the conditions of any given time. And so you are probably dinosaurs and everything else you can possibly think of, in terms of an upadi. You've probably, since infinite, you've probably been about just about every upadi you can imagine, because infinite, beginningless time. So it just depends upon the karmas which upadis you take. So now say we say, okay, the human beings themselves becoming one that has some level of sophistication, which is when we go back into all of the yugas. So human forms are there. And so as long as there's human forms there, or rishis are there, say if the only thing there is monkeys, that's it. We've evolved, everything's evolved up into monkeys. Of course Hanuman was a monkey, so. They have to be, the upadi has to be available to receive that knowledge, or that knowledge is not going to be there. If there's only animals who have no interest in knowledge, don't have any self-reflection, then that knowledge isn't going to be present at that time. It doesn't mean that knowledge isn't there to be had when the upadis are there that need it. So I would just be kind of more practical and that, and thinking, and I think also understanding evolution. It's important to understand that evolution. You can look at evolution in reference to the physical universe and the physical upadis. That makes sense, and we have a lot of evidence for that. But not evolution in reference to, of course, the self doesn't evolve. And the sukshma sharira is continually taking different upadis based upon your karma. So just think of it like this. Say 1,000 years ago, when human beings were there, you took an upadi that was appropriate for that time, with a value system appropriate to that time. Very different than it is now. You know, but if you have karmas that allow you to take a body at that time, then you do. So that's about the best I can do. Okay. If you want to look at the whole thing as a story or mythological, kind of a mythological story or some sort of a myth, if you want to look at those stories as a myth, that's okay too. It doesn't really matter. But certain things don't matter. But the pramanatvam of the Vedas matter. You know, if you don't have Shraddha, say you don't haven't been brought up as a Hindu, and in the first part of the Vedas, that's an interesting story, or it's just it's just a myth, but maybe you like the myth, you don't like the myth, whatever, you can look at it like that. But, and there's no way you can prove it or disprove it, because it's out of your range in terms of the means of knowledge you have, unless you can somehow catapult yourself up to these different lokas. You have to take the word of the Shastra for it, and if you don't, then that first part of the Vedas is not useful to you. It doesn't speak to you, it's not useful to you. But say you're a mumukshu, then if these Vedas, if the Upanishads, if you actually come to a teacher and you get that far, then they probably will be useful to you, because they are a pramana, and as long as you're available to use it, then it'll definitely be useful to you. And so a pramana, by definition, has to give you a knowledge that you don't get from another pramana, otherwise it would be that other pramana. See what I mean? Like, if the eyes allow you to see, then they're a pramana for seeing. But if something else allows you to see in the same way, then that's the pramana that they are. And so, by definition, a pramana gives you knowledge that you cannot get elsewhere. Okay? So when we talk about the Vedas, they themselves talk about it, and you talk about it as shabda pramana, say shabda, indirect knowledge. Like the first part of the Vedas, the Karmakanda, gives indirect knowledge, because how would you know for sure that there's reincarnation? How would you know that these rituals were bring the rains? You know, there's no cause and effect within this plane to throw fire and chance to throw ghee into the fire with some chance. You know, and it rains. That's not within our means of knowledge, and yet these rituals work. Okay, so you may or may not have Shraddha in that. You may not have Shraddha that there's 7 lokas up and 7 lokas down. You know, you may not have Shraddha in how they, the duties that they prescribe to you. But in the second part of the Upanishads, the second part of the Vedas, they're really talking about yourself and this world. And all, you don't need, it's not like having Shraddha and indirect knowledge, which you can never verify. Here, the Shraddha is different. It means that for some reason, we say Ishwara Anugraha, Bhagavan's grace, for some reason you have an openness to, like, open your eyes to see if they can see. And this is an openness to this particular pramana, to see if it actually gives a knowledge that no other pramana can give. And it actually does. And so as that pramana is functioning and working, you have Shraddha. You know, you find that it's working, you're seeing. It has a very wonderful pulla. There's a result, it gives a result, which is another qualifier for something being a pramana. It should give you a knowledge that nothing else can give you. And it should also have a fruit. It should have amount to something, you know. It's not just nothing. It gives a result. And so Here, for the Vedanta, it requires an openness to utilize that pramana to see what is right here to be seen. It's not like indirect knowledge. And so then, no matter how you handle all of the devatas and all the heaven worlds and all of these type of things and having your own Ishta Devata, how you feel about all of that is kind of up to you. That is the vision of the Shastra. Somebody asked Swamiji that once. Do you really believe in the devatas? This is back in 1982. Do you really believe in the devatas and all these gods and everything, Swamiji? And this is in the West, And so we were walking along, just kind of thinking, pondering it. What does he really think? And he said, "Yeah, I do." But it's the type of "yeah, I do" is that is real for me. Maybe it's not real for you, but for me, that is real. It's all in Maya, And so those. You can talk about it, like if you ever are you ever on that web, my website, that arshakulam.org, on the front page there's a picture of Swamiji and all of these talks that we had with Swamiji. They're really fantastic, actually. And there's a very good transliteration of the whole talk. He used a lot of Sanskrit, so we transcribed the whole talk and put all the Sanskrit in. But he would talk about all of these kinds of things, how to take it all, and then what is actually relevant for you, like all of these, the myths or the stories, and like all of those completely work for me. And I can't say, I don't need to say, oh, this is really a physical reality. I have no idea. It's all, that they are personifications of laws. Some people want to talk about it academically or scientifically like that. You have laws and this is a personification of the law and all these kinds. Okay, But for me, I can be totally contained in that world. Even if it's an imaginal world of the psyche, or it's the subtle world, the mythological world of Hiranyagarbha. But if it's the mythological world of Hiranyagarbha, whatever, I like that, and that works for me. But that is not the same type of knowledge that we're talking about in terms of self-knowledge and the nature of this creation. That's a direct, immediate knowledge. It's pointing to realities that are here and now for you to recognize. So I think that's the important thing. The other things, because this knowledge is held in the Shastra, in the Vedas, you have a certain respect for what the Vedas have to say. You hold it with a certain high regard. You don't have to physicalize it for it to be real. In some realm, it has its own reality that can contain you. That's how I feel about it for today. Definitely how I feel about the Vedanta. And how the Vedanta presents itself also. So. What's the relationship between the mind and the brain? Functions that can be measured in the brain, like emotions, memory, and directly of the sense organs, we give to the mind too. How are they connected? Do these functions travel with a subtle body, or do they die with a gross body? I think maybe in the simple form, how it's viewed, is that this physical upadhi that has its complexities, like the brain and the heart and the digestive system, are all enlivened by the prana, the sense organs, the organs of action, which is really just an extension of the prana. It's all rajas. The rajas is what gives all the various life forms, like digestion, and the circulatory system, and the in and out going breath, all of these things that are kind of physiological life force that pervades the body. But then the body can also walk, and it can talk, and it has sexuality, and all of these things. That's also in a way just an extension of the prana, of the utilization. It's one. And but then you have other functions like the sense organs. We have physical sense organs, and you have a brain also. In fact, what they're finding from studies, it's just very interesting, is that the brain, what we call the brain, your mind, is you just think of it's in the brain. But they're also finding that mind in the heart. There's a real connection between the heart and the brain. And in India, when they think of the brain or the mind, they think of it here. And we'll think of our mind as here. And they'll think of it as here. Anyway, the subtle body is what enlivens those capacities. The physical organs, can't see in a dead body. So that one way to kind of understand is just think of a dead body. None of the prana's not there, basically. The karmendriyas are not there. They're not functioning. The eyes are not functioning. The sense organs are not functioning. The brain is not functioning. So you look at the subtle body as that which enlivens this body. And when the subtle body is there, this body with all of its capacities are functioning. The physical body is that you have right now is the appropriate body for the subtle body based upon the flow of karmas. This body is limiting you in some ways and exalting you in other ways. Punya and papa. It puts you in a situation where your punya and papa is expressed and exhausted also. So if you wanted to say, okay, the karmendriyas is the prana that activates your hands and your feet, and you just figure, okay, what are the main organs of action for this physical body? And they call the subtle body that enlivens that, those are the karmendriyas, the organs of action that enliven this physical body. For the mind, what would the mind be enlivening? In the West, we probably say the brain, but as we figure out what really is the brain and the unconscious, then that's what the subtle body is enlivening, like that. The eyes, subtle eyes are enlivening the eyes. The subtle ears are enlivening the ears. Yeah. So you just see what would naturally be a counterpoint, to the subtle form. And that would be the physical form. So there you have the mind and the brain. The mind utilizes the brain in this physical. The subtle mind utilizes the brain as its instrument on this plane. If you remember in Tattva Bodha, this becomes the ayatana, the bhoga ayatana. It's the counter of experience for the subtle body to exhaust its punya and papa, really, through this body, because this body is made of the same material as this world. So I need a counter of an experience. The subtle body, just coming here by itself, there has no counter of experience to really communicate here. So it needs a physical body to utilize that's true, the same material as this particular loka is. And that would be true for all of the lokas. It has to take on a form made of the same material as the loka. But the subtle body is subtle. I don't know if that's good enough. That's all I've got right now.
Do you think ghosts are like subtle bodies that are still hanging around? Or is it more like an energy phenomenon that still remains after someone has traveled away with their experience?
Ghosts, there are other different words for ghosts. One common one is called pisachas. And they're viewed as, because of extreme attachment to their life and their loved ones here and their wealth, whatever combination, they hang on. And so they kind of hang around this particular loka. And so now, as part of the Hindu culture, because people don't want them to hang around, it's not good for them, and you also don't want a ghost hanging around in your home. So what they do is there's like a 10-12 day ritual when somebody dies in the household, And near the end of this, all rituals and things that are being done, but at the end they cook for their loved one who's passed a huge feast. And then just like when you do a puja, you do a sort of puja where you're feeding and you're washing them and feeding them, just imaginarily, because they're already left the home. you're imaginarily doing that and feeding them and praying to them and giving them all kinds of flowers and, you know, worshiping them. And when that whole ritual is done, then it is time for them to go. And so in so many words, I think with chants, you tell them it's time for you to go and to move on. We send you with all love and with all punya, you know. And they say that to them. And then, and so they're there. I mean, they have their picture and whatnot is there. And then what they do, the whole family, they turn around and they walk away and they don't look back, so that that jiva will feel, you know, that the axe has dropped, so to speak, and it's time for them. They have to go now. Because they accept that that there are ones that aren't ready to leave, you know, and that it's not good for them to just be hanging around. That's the thinking for them and the culture. Yeah. So. Today, Wednesday, I think Radha said something like, this body upadi is 50% real. No, that's not quite right. This body upadi is 50% real. Can you please clarify? Yeah, what I was saying is this. It's kind of tongue-in-cheek, but there's some truth in it. It is that you take this body, to be you, to be me, the conscious being. And I say, well, that's 50% correct, because just like the pot is the clay, that is true. You know, what the mitya pot is the satyam clay, and this body, mind, sense organs is in fact me, is in fact Brahman. So that part is true, but what is not known is that this myself, you know, is free of this body, mind, sense organs, and is the self of all body, mind, sense organs, is the self of the entire creation. But from the standpoint of the upadi, my self-experience is me, Brahman. It's just that I take me to be one with this body, mind, sense organs. That's the ajnana. But my sense of self is Brahman. That's why that's what I was saying earlier, if the whole universe goes away, the very me that you're most attached to is you, the very personal me, that remains. You think, you means all of us, until we gain knowledge, you think that this, the me, is really this body, mind, sense organs. And when that goes, what I'm most attached to, which is me, will go also, and then there's some sort of a soul or Brahman or consciousness that travels on. Yeah. But what the Upanishads are revealing to us is that this me actually is Brahman, is the self in all beings. And it is very personal. It's not, because people think, well, I don't want to be a universal self. I want to be me. But you are me. There's only one of you. You know. And that is me. And you say, no, that's me. No. There's only one. And that me belongs to that one. The me experience is that one, which is me. It's not me. You know, it's, and don't think universal self, like it's a great big me, and like a cookie cutter, you have this little piece of it, and you have this piece of it, and you have this piece. It's not that, because there's no time or space. So there's no size. That's all totally irrelevant. It's just non-dual, conscious being me. Non-dual me. That really is the self of Ishvara. Which is so beautiful that Ishvara is not away from you. It's not somebody else, like some god in heaven with a, you know, throwing lightning bolts. Lightning bolts and thunder, you know, sound of thunder. You see the lightning bolts and thunder in some of these drawings. You don't necessarily identify that as yourself, but when you recognize this body, mind, sense organs, all body, mind, sensors organs are part of one whole, and I am the self of that whole. I am the me. I am the self of that whole, and so this Ishvara effect is myself. It's not my not this limited upadi. It's my infinite upadi, because it's me. I'm its truth. I'm itself, the self of that infinite upadi, the self of your upadi and your upadi. See, so. You understand the 50%. 50% correct. Because the other 50% would be wrong. Because it would be I am me, and this me, this self, is this body. That's not correct. It's only 50% correct. This body, mind, sense, organs, upadi, is me, in the sense that I am its self. But this self that I am is the self in all beings. That's the Satyamiti. When you walked from the ashram, how could you recognize that you were not moving? And then you tried to move your arm. I did move my arm. Could you please explain more about this and integrate the words buddhi, atma, and ahankara? Okay. It was just, sometimes you have these subtle experiences. For some reason, your mind is more subtle than at other times than it normally is. So this is one of those times, and I was walking down from the women's dorm, where we all had our little rooms. I was walking down toward the lecture hall, and as I was walking in little ways there on the right hand side, there was the library, and I had quite a ways to walk to get to the lecture hall. And so as I was walking, for some reason, this type of meditative state came over me, through my mind was maybe more resolved and more subtle than one's mind normally is. And for some reason, there was some sort of a disassociation of viveka, I would say, between me and the walking, talking person. And all of a sudden, it came just like an experience. It's very me that is me. It wasn't somebody else. It was me. But I wasn't moving. As all these other things were moving, I was absolutely still. I wasn't moving along, for instance. My body's moving along. But the self was not moving along. It wasn't moving at all. And I recognized it, And it was like, because it was everything that Swamiji had been teaching, but I hadn't seen it like that so experientially. And so I didn't want to lose it, because it was kind of some sort of a state. And I knew that I could easily lose it, like if I moved too fast or just kind of blew it off somehow. And so I didn't want to do that. And so what happened was I decided I just kind of froze there, and I really didn't want to lose that. And so I thought, okay, well, I can't just stand here like a statue all day. So then I thought, let me experiment a little bit. And so I started, I think the first experiment was moving my head like this, because I wanted to see if myself, like here I'm moving my head, so am I this me moving like that? If I move my head. So I moved my head like this, very slowly, because I didn't want to disrupt the kind of the experience. And no, nothing happened to me. I didn't move. My head moved like this, my vision changed, it went like this. But I was not moving at all. And it was me. It was not anybody else. It was me, myself. And so that was like really amazing. And then I thought I wanted to do one more thing, And I thought, let me lift my arm and see what happens. So I got like this. And no, nothing happened to me at all. But I was moving, And then I started taking some slow steps. Class was going to start, so I thought, okay, I'm going to class. That's what happened. And it was a very beautiful experience, and it's an experience that you will never lose. That experience, actually. I mean, now I don't think about it. No, my no. Okay, but the me is always me. It was just singled out from all of these things that we identify with me. I just recognize myself just as myself, not attached to anything else. So it's one of those experiences that if you didn't have knowledge, like if I hadn't been exposed to the teaching for some time, 6-7 months, It would just be a spiritual experience of some kind, you know. But it wasn't just that, because it was everything Swamiji was unfolding, and I was seeing this way and that way, but just never so stark. So stark, so clear, so experiential. And so that was kind of an unforgettable experience. That was funny. Anyway, I couldn't stay there all day, so I left and went to class. When you clearly know and recognize that you are Ishwara, that the whole is your upadi, does the ahankara operate differently then, or is there still a sense of duality and the habit of taking yourself to be the body, mind, sense organs? I can recognize that I am the whole in meditation, but I don't really think in those terms in my daily life. See, as long as you have the parabdha, your this embodied state will continue, and it will continue just as it is before, in the sense that the subtle body is indwelling this physical body. This is all Ishwara time now. You know, the prarabdha is Ishwara, so it's not subjective. This is not a subjective reality. This is an embodied reality. You're experiencing my body just as I am, and I'm experiencing your body. So we're in shared reality in Bhagavan's reality, Bhagavan's time. So this body will continue to move and walk and sit and sleep and just do everything that it does. And you will be pervading the body because of the sense of touch, just like whether you have knowledge or not, that's not going to be any different. You know, you'll see through your sense organs. All of these things will be exactly the same. So you put the jnani here and the ajnani here, they both have the same embodiment. But the thing is, there's also a difference. It's the same embodiment from the standpoint of the body and the mind and the sense organs. But it all, the body, mind, sense organs, and the ahankara, all are mithya, even though for you. So, even though from the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs, its experience, it will be exactly the same. You'll say, I am going to the store, all of these type, you know, I'm going to the store, I'm going to take a nap, all of these things are exactly the same. What is different, though, there's a few things that are quite different. One is that the self from the standpoint of the body is the same, but the differentiated self that it never does anything from its own standpoint is you. It's very well known. It's not known as an object. This is all Kena Upanishad. It's not known as an object, but it is you. And you've recognized it, differentiated it, so that ajnanam is gone. So yourself always remains exactly as you are, exactly as me, which is not affected by the world or your emotional states or anything. In fact, it becomes like a natural sanctuary for the objectified mind, for your mind and for your moods and your emotions and what's going on in the world. You remain there, untouched. And yet, from the standpoint of the upadhi that has a subtle body, you are reflected as though in that whole body, so you have the same experience of being embodied as you did before, with the addition that the nature of your own being is you, and also is very available to your buddhi, that recognition. It is you, and it's very recognized, differentiated from the upadis because of your knowledge. Okay, so that's one thing. Then subjectively, when you recognize your being, the ananda, or the wholeness, or the indestructibility, or the changelessness of your being, and you have really recognized that you are, in fact, what you seek, you are what you seek, then my relationship with the world changes, in the sense that I don't ask the world to give me back myself, really. I don't need it to do that. I don't need the world to be in a particular way. I accept the world as Ishwara. That's that karma yoga buddhi, that Ishwara arpana buddhi, where you see the whole universe as Bhagavan. and you treat it with that type of dharma, really your relationship to the world is one of dharma, and when it's not, then that's your sadhana. Because you understand the whole thing, you understand how many lifetimes you spent in ajnanam, and so you have a lot of habitual ways of being in the world that are completely opposed to what you know to be true. And that's right, that's true, that's true for some time. And when that's a problem for you, you just bring it back. You know, you do nididhyasana. You practice being kind, and instead of acting out your anger or frustration, you sit with yourself and work on that. It's not like you swallow it and not do anything with it. You work on it, and then you practice being in the world and being with others in the way that is true to your values, you know. Maybe I can lose my temper, but I certainly don't want to, you know, inflict that on anybody. If you've ever had somebody's temper inflicted on you, it's a pretty difficult, you know. And you may have a temper too. I had a temper, you know, and I pretty much have gotten rid of it, not completely, but hope you never have to experience it. Because I don't value that. I don't value that at all. Well, I don't think we want to suppress those things. We want to work on them and see what that's really about, you know. Or if your feelings get hurt, if that happens, then you need to work on that and see what that's all about and what it is, what you're afraid of, what it is that you want, so that you can metabolize all of that and then give back something else. Even as a therapist, that we use that language that allow your client to have all kinds of different kinds of transferences on you. You might be the bad, become the bad mother, and then they just hate you for all the horrible things you did to them. They haven't done anything wrong because you're not their mother. But they have superimposed that on you, and somehow they for them that becomes very real. And so, as a therapist, I'm not going to become their mother from my side. But I'll take all of that anger and rage they're inflicting on me, because of the transference, they think I'm the mother somehow, and give back something else. You know? You give back to you metabolize all that anger, rage, or jealousy, or whatever it happens to be. Metabolize means you take it in, digest it, and give back something else. And that changes the psyche, because they're not getting treated in kind like how it used to be. They're being given something else, and that makes a huge difference, you know. So we learn how, as therapists, we do that. It's easy to do it as a therapist because that's your role in this confined space, you know. You can do that. But say somebody is really angry at you or yelling at you or being really inappropriate, you know, and the immediate response is to, bam, give it back, you know, like that. It's almost an instinctual response, but you don't have to respond that way, you know. You can take what they have to give and give back something else that you feel good about. Say you give back in kind, then you don't feel very good about that. And it also escalates, you know. Who's going to yell the loudest, you know. And it doesn't have a happy ending. It's not like it resolves. You both have to walk away for a while, really settle down, and then when you're normal, when you come back to a normal state, you come back and talk and hopefully can get through all of the damage that's been done in that angry state. It's not what we want. You end up doing that, it's just not what you want. And so then you start to realize, let me not do that. Let me work on that myself. Metabolize it, whatever it is. Let me work on that myself and give back something that I want to give back. And that's how we mature. We don't mature in the areas that we're already mature. You mature in the areas where you're not mature. And that means you have to do something a little differently. Instead of acting out those immature things, you metabolize it, you work with it, and you give back something else. And you get used to doing that. So giving back something else that's you value, that you feel good about, that feels much better. It's such a relief. And then you start to get control, a lot more control out of control over these, emotions that we're holding in the unconscious. And we learn how to deal with the emotions themselves rather than the projected emotions. I'm dealing with projected emotions, then I've put that emotion on you. Or you're the cause of that emotion. Very rarely is anyone the cause of that emotion. Very, very rarely, you're just a trigger for it. The emotion is there inside, and it's been just the right circumstance to make it a blast off. And so you learn how to, instead of blasting the other person, is to hold that emotion and be with it and say, okay, what's really hurting you? What are you really afraid of? It's usually fear. The negative emotions are usually fear-based. Really afraid of something. This person's really going to hurt you or wreck your life or. So it's very interesting. But that what I'm saying is that becomes how you deal with things. You're metabolizing all of this stuff so that you have shanti. And you feel good. That's the shamadana. It feels so good to be able to deal with the problem where the problem really is, which is inside. That's where it is, and that's where you can really help. It doesn't help to think that it doesn't help to try to solve it out here when it's not out here. That's the thing. It's very rarely out here. Mm-hmm. One more, two. Can you please talk about the menace? What does it do? I see how it causes me pain. Does it have a positive aspect as well? The menace has some very positive aspects. It's really the mind that is receiving data. The vritti receives whatever your sense organs are giving. That's manas. It receives the data from your means of knowledge. That's one thing that it does. And it also, say if you think of it as a data receiver. So it receives the data from your sense organs, from your means of knowledge. It receives from the unconscious and negative emotions that have been triggered. That's data, It's probably the instrument for imagination. And the buddhi is the one who engages that. You engage that data. You have something to say about it, or you learn from it. There's something that has to do with knowledge or clarity that comes into relationship with it. Say, even with the inner child work, your buddhi is going down as though kind of going down deep into the unconscious to be with those little ones. But that's all menace. Those little ones and all of their feelings and all of that, that's all held there. Those are like experiences held there tightly in the unconscious, and the buddhi is coming down to come into relationship with that, And so you're coming into relationship with emotions that are held in the, basically emotions and images go together, so you're going down into the unconscious to meet that. And that's what needs to happen. That's what needed to happen when you were young. It's like your mom or dad had to come in and be with you and meet you where you were and comfort you. And now, because that didn't happen in the way that it needed to anyway, now you can go in and be with that and meet it and be with it in the way that it is needed. Because since it's you, that your experience that's been sequestered down in there, you know what it is, and you know what you need. And so you can actually take care of those emotions that are that are being held. The manas, which is part, it's like part of your psyche and part of the libido, is all held inside, not allowed out. So a lot of your energy actually is taken from you, from your use to hold these complexes in the body. It takes a lot of energy. So that energy isn't available to you. And so as these things start being released, you also get more psychic energy available to you and to your body to be used rather than to be used to hold. So the manas, everything you have is very positive, because you need the manas to do all these things. You know, so that itself is positive, that you have, that the manas can hold, be a receptacle for all of these experiences. That's what it does. That's its job. The buddhi type of thoughts are the ones that engage and have knowledge and have clarity. You know, and can, like when you go in to be with the manas, with those emotions and everything, you go in as a good mother or as the wise one, really, the one who can help. That's buddhi. So, let's do one more. Okay. Oh, it's a shorty. Can you unfold abhayam? I hope I talk about this again. I'm going to talk about it now, but it's one of the things. This word abhayam is one of my words that I love, actually. In the main sannyasa vow for sannyasi, and for the whole value of ahimsa, is abhayam. Bhaya means fear. Abhayam means freedom from fear. So the sannyasa vow that in the ritual that they do is, may I not be afraid of anyone, and may no one be afraid of me. And so that becomes a vow, a commitment to not be the source of fear. And one thing too, that's why sometimes I say, you know, the main problem is fear when you're with these dvaishas. You're afraid that someone is going to hurt you in some way. Just look at next time you feel angry at somebody, or you're mad at somebody, or you really don't like somebody, then just say to yourself, what are you afraid of? What can they do to you? What's worrying you? Because if you're not afraid of anything, nothing's worrying you, then it doesn't matter. They're just who they are. It's fine. But somehow you have some fear. So if you take this part of it first, like let me not be afraid of anybody. If I can do that, then people are given the freedom to be as they are. Okay? When they're given the freedom to be as they are, then they won't be afraid of you. Because the vow is, let me not be afraid of anybody, let no one be afraid of me. But they will be afraid of you if you're afraid of them. But if you're not afraid of them, they have no reason to be afraid of you. You just have to think about that. It's really a beautiful thing, you know. So the first thing you have to do is to get rid of your fear in reference to all of the people that you have something negative going on with. You have a fear that somehow they're going to hurt you or take something away from you or make your home life miserable, you know, or be in your community and spoiling your reputation in your community here. That just actually happened with one of my not Vedanta students, but at school. I just had recently had a long we had a long Skype talk, and it had to do, this is just a little aside, but it's interesting, it had to do with a professor, one of the not in our department, but somebody that we hire as an adjunct who themselves had gone to our school. And he was extremely critical of this woman's work. She's writing her dissertation, and he was the chair of her committee. And he didn't like her work. She's actually a very brilliant woman. She's a writer. Nobody can fault her writing. I mean, she's way, way up here in professional writing. She's very brilliant. But he did not like her work. And so he gave kind of a scathing criticism and said he didn't want to work with her anymore and accused her of all of these things. It was very kind of strange. And so now the question was, what am I going to do? Like, I can't really continue working with him. You know, I can't, how can I continue working with him? But he's in my community. You know, and if I badmouth him or say anything bad about him, he will reciprocate and I will lose my community. He can do that, you know. And she said, I can also do that to him. I don't want to do that. But he would be afraid of that, and he accused her of maybe trying to destroy his community. You know? And so, what a mess! how to really get out of that? And also, he's the professor; he holds the power, so he's actually abusing her. He's abusing her, and he deserves to be reported. So we had a very, very long conversation about this. He actually should be reported. And he shouldn't be hired anymore at all because of the way he treated this student. It's highly abusive. But if she reports him in the wrong way, she will lose her whole community. That's also true because he'd be quite vindictive, you know. And so a lot of fear. She had a lot of fear, and also she's a strong person, and she doesn't want to let somebody get away with this kind of abuse because he can just do it to another student and another student. Anyway, that's just a little anecdotal situation. I just went through that, not today, but 2 days ago. We had a long conversation. I know this woman very well, and and I'm one of her advisors, so we had this conversation about how to handle a situation like that. It's really tricky, like all of these women that are reporting these abusive sexual predators. So many of these women are reporting this now. Why couldn't they do it before? Because they'd be destroyed. Their life would be destroyed by this. You know? The children, their life. You know? They'd lose their job. All of these type of things. Very, very threatening. You know? So, just keeping that in mind, it's got a lot of twists and turns if you start thinking about these type of things that maybe you've had experience with in your past, but your friends or anything. If you think of this Abayim vow, the first part of it is, you know, let me not be afraid of anybody, you know, so that they won't be afraid of me. If they're afraid of you, you know, if you're afraid of them, they will be afraid of you because you're afraid of them. It's a very kind of subtle thing. So the starting place, if you really kind of, it's good meditation to think about it. The starting place is, let me not be afraid of any being. Another way they say it, let me not be in competition with anybody. You know? That's the sannyasa vow. So let me not be afraid of any being, and let no being be afraid of me. It's quite a beautiful vow, actually. It's worth contemplating on. I can't do it justice right now, but it's really worth contemplating on. See what that actually means. Even if you don't like somebody, what does it mean to not like somebody? You're afraid of them. So if you start with, let me not be afraid of any being, that's a good place to start. Who don't I like? You know? Who do I wouldn't say it like that. You don't have to say it positively. Who do I dislike? Is there somebody I dislike? The next question is, what are you afraid of? What are you afraid of from that person? Let me not be afraid of any being. And then there's no reason to dislike them. It's a really good sadhya. Oh,
Swasti prajapyah paripalayantam Nyayena margena mahim mahishah Go brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam Loka samasta sukhino bhavantu Kale varshatu parjanyah Prithivi sasya shalini Tesho yamcho varahitah Brahmana santu nirbhayah Om sarvesham swastir bhavatu Sarvesham shantir bhavatu Sarvesham purnam bhavatu Sarvesham mangalam bhavatu Sarve bhavantu sukhinah Sarve santu niramayah Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kashchit dukha bhag bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amritam gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.